Welcome to the last session of the meeting, and the main purpose of this session has already been accomplished, which was to make sure we could give you lunch today. Those of you who work for the government will understand that. But we have a secondary purpose, which is to get some bold and interesting predictions and insight into the future of our community from the three leading lights that I've gathered for this panel. To set that up, I'm going to mention briefly a couple trends of the last 15 years and then hand it over to the panelists to see what they have to say about the next 15 years. So one trend of the last 15 years is the number of papers being submitted has gone up a little bit. Now, I would not want to claim that this is a good measure of productivity, but at least it tells you something about the activity in our community. The other trend, vulnerabilities are declining, and you can see this from the highly scientific Google Trends data. There's a very steady downward trend with those two blips earlier this year. So I've asked the panelists to answer some of these questions about, you know, does our community, should it still exist 15 years from now, and what kinds of things will happen in research over the next 15 years. So I'm going to hand things over to Amit Sahai, who's going to be the first presenter. He's a professor at UCLA and the PI for this new Center for Encrypted Functionalities.
All right, thank you. So one of the first questions that David asked, actually, when we were asked to be on the panel, was a question of whether we'll ever get out of the cat and mouse game for security. I think, unfortunately, the answer is that we'll never get out of it. There will always be a cat and mouse game. And this is just because it's true of any adversarial human activity throughout our history, if you look at war, crime, et cetera. But I think there is a hope that we can move from, you know, having systems that are being attacked by hackers and having a cat and mouse game between systems and vulnerabilities to having models and then hackers attacking the models and working in this way, where this would have the advantage that we could have proofs of security or quantifications of risk in these models and make progress in that way. Of course, abstraction is an unavoidable aspect of building any kind of model. We can't hope to have abstractions that go all the way down to the levels of quarks and electrons and a full understanding of human behavior. But I think that we nevertheless, and despite the fact that we're very far from this, I think we can make very important progress here. I come from the cryptographic side of the research community. And I think from in that perspective, working from the bottom up, we've seen a lot of interesting progress. The center that I'm heading deals with mathematical program obfuscation, which, for example, for the first time, looks at a model where an adversary has full access to the entire computation that's taking place, and we still are able to provide some kind of security guarantees in terms of secrecy. And there's been a lot of other work along these lines, like protocol concurrency and physical attacks. And I think that's a trend that will continue. I hope it'll continue. Of course, there will still always be holes because a model is never a perfect reflection of reality. But I think that we can, by making our models better over time, find ways of making the attacks much more difficult and much more costly, which is the main objective that we share. So, okay, what about predictions? I was also asked to make a few predictions. So, this is actually my old slides. I see. These are the wrong slides.
Sorry about that. Okay. The predictions have changed. The predictions changed, yeah. In the last 5 minutes what we want to predict for.
Right. So since I was asked to make a prediction, and I'm a cryptographer, I did so in an encrypted format. This is my encrypted prediction. I will open it in 2029. You can see if I was right. I'm using a very secure system, a one-time pad. I will reveal the pad in 2029, and we'll see if we're if I was correct. okay, joking aside, let me make a few random predictions. So the one I'm most confident about is that NSF will continue to sponsor fantastic security research that I feel very comfortable making. I can hope that as we move forward, we'll be able to develop more and more security systems where the security is based on mathematical hardness. We can expand the reach of mathematical hardness to other areas where currently it doesn't have much to say. I think mathematical hardness has proven to be a very resilient building block. I also hope that cryptographic innovations, such as secure multi-party computation and zero-knowledge attestations and things like this, of course also obfuscation, hopefully, will become more widely used, perhaps starting with the very high security arena and moving downward from there. I also think that we're going to see more and more use of physical assumptions to prevent purely remote digital attacks. Hopefully, password-based or password-only, I should say, authentication will become extinct by 2029. That's a, I guess, somewhat controversial prediction. Another issue is that right now we're seeing sort of the Snowden, post-Snowden era. But there may very well be pushback at some point later on if there's a major terrorist attack, which was really enabled by the security research that we are all doing, something that maybe we should keep in mind. And there, of course, there'll be many, many new attack targets by 2029. Certainly cryptocurrency, that's already here. But I think another trend that we'll see is these cyborg devices, right? Devices that are designed to enhance our perception. If that gets hacked, it'll be quite fascinating to see what happens. Just wrapping up with something that we've seen a lot of already, I think definitely the basic problem that we have, if you will excuse my somewhat crude language here, is, you know, is it really possible to make castles out of excrement? This is sort of the situation that we are often faced with. We have poor quality software, is something that we've heard many times. And certainly, if you're a if you're developing the next, hopefully, billion-dollar startup company, then you may not be too worried about security. It's this thing that we see over and over again. And we see a lot of software written with duct tape that somehow remains too long. So what are the hopes here? Something we've talked about a lot today is the possibility of smart regulation, for example, perhaps through mandatory insurance against attacks. Perhaps with some government reinsurance to mitigate some of the bigger and more unknown risks that such an insurance company would face. Could this lead to non-buzzword-based compliance? You know, this is something that would be really wonderful if instead of buzzwords, we actually had real ways of showing that we're making progress. Another hope, I think, is the proliferation of security as a service, right? The idea of you know, using PayPal or third-party authentication to move out a lot of the vulnerabilities that we currently see. And it, you know, perhaps it gives a way that we can have security without stifling the pace of innovation that we really need to preserve going forward. And finally, just to conclude very quickly, I certainly hope that there'll be more engagement and better engagement between all of us in this community and policymakers so that we can hopefully get some of these better outcomes for the future. Thanks.
So our next panelist is Carl Landwehr. And Carl was actually the first program officer for what's essentially SATSI. It was called Trustworthy Computing back then, but the history of having a SATSI program doesn't go back as far as we're trying to predict forward. So, on to Carl.
Not sure if this is on. Is this on? It is. Okay, great. because I'd rather just talk from here. So Dave gave us a few questions to answer, which I'll answer very quickly. Will there be a SATSE 2029? Yes, of course there will be, except it won't be called SATSE, of course, because it was called Trusted Computing initially, and it's had some other names in between, and you have a bureaucracy thing. You can't keep anything with the same name for that long, so that won't happen. Which out there research ideas of today might gain adoption by 2029? Okay, so a caveat on this, I think out there ideas are rare, and there may be some that I'm completely unaware of. But I would say three that I would look for in 2029 would be perhaps some effective use of the recent homomorphic encryption and obfuscation results that we've seen from the crypto community, and I'm sure Amit could give us a better account of those than he did in his talk. Maybe we can get into that later. I hope we'll have some interaction. I have still some hopes for correct by construction software and firmware. It's not a new idea. It still seems to be out there somewhat. I think there are some possibilities for that. And a third thing I would hope to see anyway in 2029 would be more practical information flow tracking so that people can understand where their information goes, and I think there should be better technological support for that. And I think so information flow, you know, awareness of information flow and systems should be better by then, I hope. Things we are pursuing today that will become irrelevant, you asked for. I actually don't think there's very much that's going to become irrelevant in truth. I would hope that there would be a much stronger consensus by 2029 on how to build systems that can meet security requirements and a stronger willingness to embrace those methods in industry. I think the Internet of Things may help somewhat in that because there'll be more sort of physical consequences to things that may drive us in that direction. Certainly, what I look forward to owning at some point a self-driving car, and I think the idea that my self-driving car can be hacked will be a problem for auto companies that they will have to deal with. And thirdly, Dave asked us to comment on what will be the biggest security privacy research problems in 2029. So in that line, I'm going to take advantage of the slides. And I have 10 questions that I think we might consider as things we would like to learn. So first is how to avoid building security flaws into programs. These are kind of text-intensive slides, and I'm not going to go through all the details, but I'll be glad to make them available at the end. In each of these cases, I've put, what is the problem a little bit, and what do we know, where are we now, and where are we going? But I'm not going to go through those details here. I'm just going to go through the questions. So how to avoid building security flaws into programs, that still seems to be a problem. We have a lot of programs coming out with flaws in them. And although that was an interesting chart, actually, was that the chart of using the word vulnerability in
The Google Trends search is on the topic vulnerability.
The topic. Okay, so the topic doesn't really have anything to do with the number of vulnerabilities.
I think it does.
Think so?
Yeah.
Okay.
It has a little bit to do with it.
Okay. I hope. Second
it's
thing,
I the peaks when shell shock and Heartbleed happened.
Right, so then people talked about it more, but I'm not sure that, well, whatever.
People talking about it is a measure of it being important at some level.
Yes. Second thing, how to know when a system's been penetrated. That's still a problem. We still see a long gap between. Suddenly somebody figures out that, I guess the latest one I saw was, which retailer was it in the last couple of days, is rumored to have been had. And the evidence comes because they see a pattern of transactions, financial transactions, that looks like a bunch of their credit cards were compromised. So that's still a problem. How to design systems that can tolerate intrusions. I still don't think we have a good recipe for that. How to design systems with manageable security. Right now, there's a tremendous market for people in the cybersecurity area. A lot of it has to do with trying to administer these systems in a way that they get set up properly, right? How to provide reasonable protection of intellectual property. It's still a concern, right? Everyone, in the end, what people want are what I've referred to as mission impossible bits. They want you to be able to read it once, and then it goes up in smoke the way those tapes used to go up in smoke, for those of you old enough to remember that program. There are some techniques out there, but right now we're at the legal enforcement stage, really. How to support privacy enforcement technically. We have to understand what we mean by privacy enforcement, too. I think that's a significant barrier that we could certainly spend some time talking about. This one, actually, Amit had the same thing. I would say it's how to build a silk purse out of a sow's ear problem. How to get trustworthy computations from untrusted platforms. This is maybe a little easier, actually, than that. And there are a few examples of that. How to prevent and withstand denial of service attacks. It's still an issue, right? And how to quantify security trade-offs. You know, we don't have good ways of quantifying those trade-offs, I think. And I think this is the last one, how to reveal and minimize assumptions in security system designs so you know what you're depending on. And this is sort of the ultimate problem, if you want to summarize it all, is how to build programs and systems and know what they do. And, you know, that's really, in some sense, what this is all about. Now, what I want to tell you in terms of forecasting ahead 14 years, I'm not sure why it was 14 years, but actually back 14 years is when I gave this talk. And in fact, I gave it at the University of Virginia, Dave, so you may remember these slides. These are exactly the same slides I presented 14 years ago.
Probably no one else remembers that.
With that, I'll turn it over to Ben.
So in some brief comments, I'd like to echo, it's always worst and best to go last for these things. I get to repeat some of what I heard before, but I think the last comment by Carl is really important, and the notion that we're saying the same things 13, 14 years ago is indicative of really what the security community is. So in preparing for this panel, I went back about 15 years and I read all of the paper titles from the big three conferences, and I was trying to develop some sense of what the trends were. Were we consistently marching towards some sort of unified goal, or were we sort of jumping around to different topics? And the truth of the matter is the answer to that is yes. We were actually doing both. In fact, the security community has evolved over the last 15 years as I've been involved in it, in really two areas. There's one side of the security community which is basically following the tectonic movements in the internet at large. So basically you have these major changes in the way computation occurs. For example, just the invention of the internet completely was a game changer for everyone. And then that game changer changed again when we saw high-speed connectivity to the home and to the businesses. Mobility, in particular when you start having mobile platforms like smart devices, was another big game changer. And then finally you have the cloud revolution. And all of these things sort of, at each time, you can literally see how, within maybe a year or so, how the focus of the security community changes. And that is fundamentally what we are. We're sort of chasing the next set of revolutions. And so to understand where we're going to be 15 years from now, we have to sort of predict what those revolutions are going to be. And I have a couple of predictions. I didn't use a pad for them, but here they are. I mean, the first one is security-aware hardware. I think the hardware community has, up until the last maybe 5 or 10 years, had not been deeply involved in the discussion about what makes a secure system. And I think that is going to fundamentally, the kinds of primitives that we're going to get from our hardware systems are going to change how we approach the security problem, certainly within operating systems and applications. The big social change is going to be driven by this next bullet, which is we're going to, in the next 15 years, reach a point at which we have essentially as much bandwidth as we want and computation as we want and anywhere we want it. And so what is that going to mean for computation and particularly for security? We're talking about things like privacy. Certainly that's a big factor. Security compromises. When you have this kind of computation model, it'll definitely be a game changer. Some of the more interesting things that have really come to the fore in the last 12 months or so, I saw a great a demonstration by some folks in Japan where they were had a fully functioning exoskeleton. Can you imagine if the average dock worker was wearing an exoskeleton that could lift, say, 3 or 4 tons to move boxes and load and unload shipping containers? Could you imagine what kind of computational threats that might introduce? There's also things like, you know, we've all talked about Google Glasses and personal augmentation by computation. That's going to change our security model, and that's going to change the way we interact with the world in ways we can't possibly understand today. We heard a lot about public policy. Public policy, I hear a lot of people decry the technical private policy in this country. Within a short period of time, I think we've gotten much smarter in public policy, and I think that trend is going to continue. And the kinds of public policy that are being laid out are going to start setting the stage much more clearly for us. Now, I think probably the largest impact that the future will hold in terms of changing the way the computational artifacts get generated is this last piece, which is software liability and compliance. Basically, there are going to be much stronger incentives within the industrial community, and therefore by indirection on us as the academic security community, to improve security. There will be not just more funding, but more urgency. And I think there will be more willingness to change the way the commercial space actually works. But that's only one half of the puzzle. The other half of the puzzle is we're going to continue to do old science. If I'm predicting 15 years in the future, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, the old science is, guess what? The things that we were doing in the 1970s and 1980s with program analysis, we found the killer app. We are seeing the new renaissance of program analysis because security is this killer app. We're talking about how do you make systems that you know what they do, or how do you make sure that the systems that you build are actually achieving the goals that you have set out for it. Well, that's the basic science that you need before you can get there. If you don't have this, you don't have that. And so we have to continue, we will continue to invest in the basic fundamental research of computer science. Crypto, and I threw this out to antagonize Amit, is crypto's going to get better, but continue this never-ending cycle of creating algorithms and breaking them and starting all over again. I think we're seeing that, at least in the commercial space, some, although there are some astounding fundamental results coming out today. We're going to see, and I come from a systems community, we're going to see more and more systems where the ability to forward systems that are going to be used in practice, unless it is security, is a first-order primitive or addressed in a direct way, it's not going to be acceptable. And then finally, Carl mentioned this just briefly, and I think this is really important, is as hard as we know security metrics are, and as much as we'd like to not have to do them, we still have to do them. If we can't measure it, we don't know how we're doing. And we're going to just have to keep pulling at this Gordian knot until we make better progress. Some of the other questions. So David asked, is there anything we're doing today that will go away or will not be important because we have wins? And I think this is the wrong question. I'm not even really sure what a win would look like. I think the real question is not how do we find the panacea, find the magic fairy dust to solve some fundamental security problem, but how do we just get better at limiting the impacts when some of our security assumptions fail? How do we reduce the impact? How do we prevent Target from losing 10 million or 40 million or how many customer records? Can we reduce that impact? And maybe that's what we should consider a win rather than have this panacea. That being said, I think as a security community, I think as things like software liability and the pressures of PR continue, I think we probably will be getting more and more out of the business of taking commercial systems and breaking them and writing papers about them. Will SATSI exist in 2029? Yeah, but I think it'll look different. I think of security now probably in a different, well, certainly in a different way than I did 15 years ago. But as I've watched the community evolve over the last 5 years, I'm seeing more and more communities become attached to security. We're no longer this sort of isolated piece. If we're just like efficiency, right? Efficiency is something that everybody needs. It's not its own community. Of course, there are people that are really, really focused on efficiency, but it becomes an aspect of every other community. The PL community has security is becoming important. Systems, it's becoming important. So I think the SATSI of 2029 will be look very similar to this, only there will be a lot more people from different disciplines of computer science. And we're actually seeing this, you know, in the diversification of the community today with ethics and social sciences and things like that really coming to the fore in the security programs. So one last, and I'll make this very short, one, you know, out there idea that's been bouncing around for a little while is I think we need to move from a fundamentally change the way we look at computation. We need to move to what I would say are least feature systems. We need to develop hardware and software systems that do the job that you have for that specific instance at that specific time and nothing else. You need to be able to build, say, if you want I'll pick an Apache server. Do you really need 7,000 modules all loaded into memory or however many modules are loaded by default? No. You should be able to create a system that will look at the context of a particular operation and build only that software for it. And you could even extend that idea to hardware. Wouldn't it be interesting to be able to build the hardware, manufacture the hardware in some automated way for a very specific purpose, and therefore it can't be manipulated by an adversary? And there's a little bit of a foreshadowing in an area that I'm working in CRA, which is the Cyber Research Alliance, called Agile Systems. We're looking at systems that are customizable and modifiable at runtime. And finally, I would just say, you know, this whole idea is move away from this general purpose computational model and move away from the maximally capable systems to the minimally capable systems to get the job done. Thanks.
Okay, so I want to encourage people to come to the microphones to ask questions. This is your chance to ask questions about pretty broad topics covered by this panel. While you're lining up, I'll ask the panelists, because I disagree a little bit that the topics in conferences have not changed at all, because I remember one of the first conferences I went to was USENIX Security 2001, and of course there was a session on eliminating buffer overflows. And if you went to USENIX Security, the most recent one, there was no session on eliminating buffer overflows. We're not that ambitious anymore. We have sessions on things like mitigating how hard it is to exploit them and things like that. We have people lined up, so I won't ask my question now. You're first on this. Yes.
Reza Dok from Stony Brook University. I just went online again to langpop.com to see what languages are, you know, most popular. And, you know, C++ has gone down to number 4, Java is number 2, but C is still number 1. And, you know, there's no, you know, apparent hope that it will change. And people have been predicting the demise of Fortran for like, you know, decades, and it's not happening. Is anyone willing to predict the creation or emergence of a new language in the next 10 plus years that would actually be in the top 5 or something like that, completely displace something, all the others?
Well, I'm willing to work in that direction. I can't be sure it'll happen, but I think, you know, some of you probably already know, I mean, I've been frustrated that we haven't been able to make more progress with the things that we know how to do. And I think one way to do that, I think relying on getting direction from the government is a fantasy, not because the government couldn't give good direction, but because any direction it gives will be resisted. And so I think the way to work is to work with industry and to try to create a consensus among the research and engineering community as to what are the right tools to build systems out of that will be safe to use. And I think right now, we have, secure coding standards for C, for example, and you can try to teach those to everybody, but you'll never reach everybody who's coding. And so it's really not a long-term strategy that will work. And for a long-term strategy, I think we do need to look to different languages and languages that, in fact, people can use without being subject to these kinds of problems. So I don't know. I can't predict what's going to happen, but I really do think if we're going to mature as an engineering community, it has to happen.
Right, and there's an open debate right now, you know, within the secure programming languages community about what are the right primitives. So I think people are trying to find that language that has the good functional piece that C obviously offers with the good security primitives and guarantees. And I think there's been a lot of progress made, you know, languages like GIF allow you to provide something. The problem remains is how do you do that and make it still accessible to a user? How do you make every programmer not have to be a PhD in programming languages to do that? So I think there are hard problems here that people are working on to make secure languages. And you know, people are making progress. I can't predict how far they'll come by 2029, though.
So I'm going to actually answer your question and give a prediction, which won't be encrypted, which is that, yes, we will get rid of C by 2029, and it'll be replaced by something like Mozilla's Rust or something along those lines that's happening and finally getting close to the stage where we should be able to replace C. I'll be very disappointed if we have not replaced C by 2029.
So I'll just make one comment. A lot of us here are professors at universities. If computer science departments reach a consensus, then we can very easily affect—not very easily, maybe—but we can affect the training of the next generation of computer scientists. So that's another avenue to explore.
I think you're optimistic that it's going to disappear, but I think if we could get it out of the new software development line, that would be a success.
Yes.
Hello, Sibin Mohan from UIUC. This is mostly motivated by the last talk where you said things like static analysis and programmatic analysis have now found their killer app, right? Security and stuff. So do you envision a situation where maybe automated security integration or algorithms or machines actually applying the security primitives and coming up with new ideas might actually be the way to go instead of leaving it to humans who are error prone and stupid in many cases? We have systems being designed and more machine learning and other algorithms are being used for that. So maybe they are better at applying these security techniques because they can explore things better.
So there's really two issues here. The first one you put your finger on, which is, can we automate the proving of invariants about systems that we build? We write some code and we want to approve variant A, invariant A, B, and C. And the question, and I see there is an enormous amount of work heading in that direction, particularly as it relates to security, and we're making a lot of strides there. The second question is, what are the set of invariants? And that's a much harder question, because that's highly contextual based on how the software is going to be used, under what situation, what might be a secure piece of code in one instance might not in another. So I think they're really complementary problems, but I think. We are making progress, and I do see us making an enormous amount of progress by 2029, because I think the industrial incentives are enormous now, and they're going to get worse in the future. The second half is really a question about security modeling, and I probably have less to say about that.
I'm Deborah Shands from NSF, and I was wondering, Patrick, in your predictions, you had proposed the move to more least feature type systems, and possibly then customized operating systems and systems like that were built specifically with the least amount needed to support those features. And I'm wondering, sort of, two questions related on that. One is, do you see an approach to a distribution model for code? Currently we have we're giving the monster package of code because we really can't figure out how to distribute little bits and pieces and make sure they all fit together. So we'll give you this monstrosity, and you capture the whole thing, and you're going to use just some slim number of the features there. Mm-hmm. So do you see either a distribution model, or do you see perhaps, sort of in the application side, the move to services instead of, you're actually going out and buy applications, you get a license to use services for a year or something like that as an approach to doing that least feature thing?
So this kind of goes hand in hand with one of my other predictions, and the other prediction was infinite computation, infinite bandwidth, infinite mobility. And again, it really wasn't a prediction, but a wild idea that could have potential long-term payoff. So what I envision for such a system, it would be able to, in some way, to have a specification at a particular moment in time for a particular function. They would say, this is the kind of Apache server I need. It needs to have the following functions. Here's the content I'm going to provide. Go build me. Go to Apache's distribution server. Here's the specification. It's going to build me a custom application, and it's going to get it back to me, obviously, in a secure manner. And the fact that I have infinite computation and infinite bandwidth, this is going to be something that I can modify very quickly and change it on the fly. There are a lot of engineering problems that I just introduced, you know, all in one shot. But I do think if we have systems which are limited in functionality, limited in capability to the things that are appropriate for a particular context, obviously we're going to have a much more, you know, secure system. So I think that's kind of what the big payoff would be.
Thanks. Alec Yasensack, University of South Alabama. The first thing I'd like to do is to challenge the group here to look at the slides and for their research agenda for the next 15 years, pick one topic that they can research on and make enough progress that Carl won't be able to use the same slides as 29 that he used here today. So if we have that, if everybody commits just to one slide, maybe we'll make that happen. And my question is really two questions, or maybe it's just one. You know, high assurance has had a lot of play in the history. There's been a lot of good work done in high assurance. Really no discussion of it here today. Is there really anything left of high assurance systems that will move forward into 2029? Or the second part of the question, or maybe the same question, are formal methods dead in information security?
Oh, I think so. There actually has been some significant progress in terms of certainly the scope and scale of systems and that have been had some properties verified about them. We've got a SEL, whatever it is, that the Australians did kernel of. And I think, you know, I've actually, oddly enough, I had a by my standards, certainly a very young guy who's trying to get a startup started in this area of actually verified code. So I think that's well, you know, one of my hopes, if not predictions, is correct by construction will have a bigger impact than it's had so far. So I think there are real opportunities there, and that's part of having tools that are safe to use, I think.
Patrick, you mentioned this idea of infinite bandwidth, infinite sort of computational resources. But I don't think we're going to have infinite storage. And there is an enormous amount of data that gets generated exponentially larger and faster. There is an incentive to keep as much of it as possible. And the biggest problems that I see in my area of storage is our ability to store as much of it for as long as possible and be able to process it fast. So I suspect that, yeah, we may have a lot of, you know, sitting cycles available and maybe bandwidth, but I don't know that it will be enough to copy exabytes of data left and right. But it's possible that in 10 or so years, what we're going to see is a very small number of organizations or governments are actually able to hold the vast majority of the data of the world. And, you know, they're going to be the ones that control information and control what happens, because they're going to be the one who have a view into everything, and the rest of us may not. So I wonder what people have to say about this data explosion in 10 or so years.
So I sort of got hooked on that last statement about one or a few organizations being able to hold all of the data. So I think I think it's undeniable that the data explosion is upon us, and it's only going to get worse over time. Is there a diminishing return after some point? Is there going to be a point at which we don't really need to save all of that data? Are we going to have, do we really need to know every text that everyone ever sent? Maybe. Do we need to know what the headers were for every IP packet ever sent? Probably not. So I think we're going to get better over time. I think we're going to get away from this is probably controversial, get away from the hype of data collection. I think we're going to probably collect less over time. We're going to be smarter about what we collect. I think we'll be from a security standpoint, I think this consolidation idea is really, you know, one could look at it as the Library of Thieves, in which it's this vast repository for the betterment of mankind, but it's also a place where, we can all be held hostage. So I think there'll be a lot of public policy debate and a lot of technical debate about what giant repositories are and what they do. But I guess that's kind of a non-committal answer. I think we're gonna collect less. I think there will be, there's diminishing returns. But I also think the consolidation of storage is
fairly frightening property.
Not really responding to your question, but just about the idea of the infinite computation, that would really be wonderful, I think, especially for cryptography, in the sense that we've seen in the past, you know, back when RSA was introduced, it was just way too slow, and now, of course, it's not that slow.
So if it's really infinite, cryptography would be pretty broken.
Well, that's the thing. No, but that was my point. My point is that cryptography is based on the idea of polynomial overhead for the honest guys and exponential overhead for the attacker. And, of course, when you said infinite, you don't really mean infinite, but you meant something where that becomes more and more relevant. So I think that essential foundation of our field in cryptography becomes more and more relevant as we near that limit.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous about the notion of anything becoming infinite. If you went 14 years ago and looked at where we are now, it would probably look sort of infinite. And I've got, I've got 8 gigabytes of storage that's lost in the bottom of my pocket. So I'm a little nervous about that. But I am interested in the consequences of big data, because I think there are, quite positive consequences from that as well as negative ones. And I've done some thinking about what might be realistic. And one of the areas that I think is important in this regard is healthcare. There's a guy who's now at Michigan, Charles Friedman, I think is his name, who's been advocating this notion of a learning healthcare system. And the argument is that as a country, we're now investing a lot of money in automating our healthcare records. If we don't make it possible to analyze those records, we've put a lot of money into something without getting a huge benefit that's there. But if you want people's health records, nobody wants to propose or advocate for a national healthcare record database, okay? So the answer has to be the data is distributed, and people enable access to it on the basis that there's a public good that they recognize. I think we have to, as a community of people who know about security, be honest that there are risks when you allow other people to get at your data. Anonymization is imperfect at best. So there's always a chance of re-identification if the data has been anonymized. In healthcare in particular, it's almost axiomatic, I think, that the extent to which you try to anonymize it and protect it in that way, you lose information about that might be of value in determining what's the effective treatment. So to me, the bargain that I would put before the public is to say we need to have systems in which we can take advantage of this data. And you have to be understanding that there are some risks that you might be re-identified at some point. But what we have to build into the systems is the means to enable redress when that happens. We're not going to have systems that are perfect. Something bad will happen. But there has to be some assurance that the person who makes the mistake who does something malicious is accountable for that. That there's a way to pay a price. So I think that has implications for how we engineer the technologies in this area so that we can get the benefit out of the data that we would like to get.
Chris.
I'm going to throw out a hypothesis here or statement and just see what you have to say to it. I would suggest that the reason why we see legacy slides up here is because we're stuck with legacy systems. And by that, I don't just mean that the code was written 14 years ago, but that we've had to be compatible at each step of our change, at each step with what was there before. And as a result, we're stuck with the problems. And that if we were to throw everything away and start from scratch today, that we wouldn't have nearly the type of problems we have. The question is, I'm not advocating we throw everything away and start from scratch, but how does this change, if this view is correct, how does this change what we should be doing as a community? Or how does this affect what we should be doing as a community?
Well, the first thing I want to say is I think we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves about those 14-year-old slides. I mean, what those are hard problems, okay? And they're still hard problems, and we the solutions aren't, I don't feel too bad in a way that they're still make sense as hard problems to attack. They're different. We know more about them now than we did then. in terms of whether we have to, you know, whether legacy is a problem for everything. You know, we keep inventing new stuff. Now, we build it out of old stuff in a lot of cases. That's true. But in many cases, we don't. You know, we actually do build things from scratch, and changes do happen. I think, you know, what can motivate change is a vision of a, you know, of a different future. And that's, you know, what you want to have is a vision for where you want to be, and then figure out how you get there. And I, you know, I'm not as pessimistic, but I don't have a solution in my pocket either.
I guess I would I'll be the pessimist, I guess. We continue to make the same problem. We continue to make the same mistakes even with new code. You know, we're the reasons we make these mistakes, avoidable mistakes, now have, at least on the industrial side, have more to do with economics than it really does. If somebody wants to invest the money to make a new product very secure, then they're welcome to do so. There are tools or analysis that didn't exist 5 or 10 years ago. But people don't spend the money on that. People are making dumb decisions about how they do simple stuff that we know how to do, like authentication every single day in startups. I think it's a question of incentives. I think if we started over today, we would end up with many of the same problems. It'd be nice if we had a set of tools that say, hey, if you stop writing in this and start writing in this, you're going to get better problems. But you're, in the end of the day, you're still dealing with the same software problems, the same market pressures, the same security versus time to market trade-offs and things like that. So I don't think, you know, having a complete a dawn in America where we can just suddenly start writing brand new code for everything is going to solve the problem, because I don't think the legacy stuff is important, but I don't think it's really the thing that's driving future insecurity, although it is a piece of the puzzle.
So I just wanted to comment on that, just to perhaps introduce a ray of hope in that space, having you know, participated in projects, you know, large systems being built with considerable code reuse. You know, recent experience where, you know, very, very large system with probably, you know, well over 50% of the software in the system was reused. And when the when the system integrator was obliged to at least run, you know, static analysis software on that code, the new code was vastly superior to the old code, vastly superior. Most of the problems they had to fix, and of course they hadn't really predicted that we were going to make them do that other part, the old stuff. But the vast amount of time they spent trying to solve those problems was with the old software. And so the coding standards that large system integrators right now have are producing dramatically better results, at least based on the kinds of things you could look at with, you know, static analysis tools, right? Significantly better. So, you know, was it perfect? No. Did they still have problems in the new stuff? Sure. But percentage-wise, it wasn't even close. So, you know, I would say that's just one little bit of, you know, some of these things are making us better. And one of our big challenges is, you know, what, you know, was the buyer of this big software system saving money? They thought they were when they specified they wanted a bunch of code reuse. But I predict that maybe they weren't once they found out that they needed to do all this amelioration of these problems.
So was the static analysis done in order to enable the reuse?
The static analysis was required to go over the whole system and make sure that, you know, we knew what the vulnerability issues were in the system and fix what could be fixed.
And did the buyer require that?
Yes.
Okay. I think educating, I mean, that's actually, if we can get buyers to make those enlightened requirements,
right.
That's a huge right. that win. Was, so it and, may be and, that organizing the consuming community is part of them.
Yeah, I think that's a huge aspect of it, and then making the people who are building these systems aware that they're going to be held to this standard, which was a new thing for them as well.
So I think that the time has come, and I wanted to end this on an optimistic note. So thanks, Deborah, for doing that. I want to thank the panelists, and Jeremy is going to close our meeting. So thank the panelists.